Hadassah, and I'm so excited to welcome you to Real Woman, Real Torah, a project of Becheva Learning Center. We're here to offer you an authentic Torah learning experience, produced for woman, by woman. I hope you enjoy.
Got me thinking a lot about the idea of Medrash in general. And definitely one of the most helpful sources to find, you know, how to approach Medrash or how to understand Medrash comes straight from the Rambam. So that's one of the things that we're going to be focusing on today. How does Rambam, what is Rambam's approach to understanding Medrash and all the different kinds of Medrashim? But the first thing we have to do is pretty much try and define Medrash in general. So just, I guess, to start off with, there's two main categories of Medrash when we're talking about it in general. One is this idea of Medrash Halacha, which is all of the halachas that are extrapolated from the words of the text, from Tanakh primarily. And the other one is Medrash Agoda. And Medrash Agoda, and they're both found in the Gemara, and they're both found throughout Torah Baal Peh, but whereas Medrash Halacha is pretty much telling us, you know, how to live our lives as Yidden and giving us all of the different ways to keep Halacha, Medrash Agoda is more the stories and the sayings and the mysterious personalities or encounters that we find throughout Torah Baal Peh. Also extrapolated from Torah Shabbat, from the written Torah, but the things that are less what to do and more behind the scenes information and stories. So that's pretty much what the term Medrash encompasses, Medrash Halacha and then Medrash Agoda. And all the Midrashim that I'm going to be talking about, and yes, both are found in En Yaakov, or both are found in general throughout the Gemara, but En Yaakov primarily deals with the more agadic in nature. So they're talking about the stories and the personalities and the encounters and the interesting sayings. So that's pretty much what this shiur is based on. How are we to approach that type of Medrash? So when I've used the terms Medrash, when I use the term Agada, I'll be using them interchangeably because I'm pretty much talking about Medrash Agada, the stories part. And of course, we know that the Gemara in general is made up of those two categories, of those two areas of Torah, one Halacha and the other one is Agada or Agadata. So how do you actually define what is Agada, what is Medrash Agada? So we know, first of all, that Yiddishkeit has, it's a religion based on rules and a religion based on details. And there are many details and many rules. And there's a huge array of mitzvahs that are performed on an hourly, on a daily, on a monthly, on a weekly, on a monthly, on a yearly basis. And when we kind of, you know, when it could come to a point that a person could chas v'shalom just be doing these kinds of things automatically by rote, not really thinking much about what it is. And you know, if you don't know where to turn to for answers and for, you know, reasons why we do these kinds of things, and perhaps, you know, your curiosity can begin to fade and your excitement or enthusiasm about keeping these mitzvahs and keeping the halachas can begin to fade as well. And it can become, you know, there's a risk of it becoming not something that's, you know, alive and interesting and meaningful for you, but something that's just a series of like mechanical acts that are, you know, that don't have that much meaning, God forbid. And that's the risk that you know, we take when we don't have meaning or inspiration in our lives. So that's pretty much the point. That's where Medrash and where Agadata comes into the picture, because there is an area of Torah that discusses these kinds of questions. Why are we here? Why do we do what we do? Why are these kinds of things important? Why are the fundamentals of Torah, Shabbos, Kashrus, Tefillah, Emunah, etc., all these kinds of things, why are they discussed so often? How are they discussed? And these are the kinds of questions and topics that are discussed very much in the world of Agada. Of course, we turn to other areas of Torah for these kinds of answers as well, for inspiration and meaning in our lives. We know that Hasidus, that's pretty much the point of Hasidus, the why of Yiddishkeit, to bring back the geschmack, the pleasure of Torah. But if you take a look at the teachings and the works of the Rebbeim, especially, you know, our Rebbe, the many examples of and midrashim and sayings and agadic homilies that are found throughout Tanakh and Shas, he expounds upon them very, very much in a lot of all the Rebbeim, very much in Sichas and Maimorim. So Agadata really is this essential part of Yiddishkeit that helps us very much with our feeling towards Yiddishkeit, which then, of course, helps us towards that actually keeping Torah mitzvahs, keeping Yiddishkeit. So when it comes to defining the term or even translating the term, it pretty much defies a one-word translation. A lot of the times you'll find the word agada translated as stories or legends, but that falls very short. It does a massive disservice to what agadita truly is. And perhaps one of the best definitions of agadita that I found was something from Rabbi Emanuel Bernstein. And he says that it's pretty much a good way of explaining or defining the term agadita is all of the teachings of Chazal that are not halachic in nature. So in other words, agadita deals with the aspects of Yiddishkeit that go beyond the details or the specifics or parameters of the mitzvahs and instead focuses on the areas such as our outlook, Jewish philosophy, what are our values, our ethical conduct, and those kinds of things that really make us into the thinking, breathing, sentient, amazing people that we are. Agadita can teach us how a Jew should view Hashem, should view life, should view Torah mitzvahs, the world, people around him, and ultimately himself. And in a sense, really, Agadita is what we would call Yiddishkeit. It's all of those things in addition to halacha, how to actually keep mitzvahs. So when we take a look at kind of the comments of Chazal about how they were to define agadita in general, so the first thing that you have in your source sheet, this is a source one over here, it's a direct quote from Tehillim, and it says Tehillim Perek Chof Ches Pasuk Hey, and it says over here, Ki lo yavino opelos Hashem vel maase yodov, that they don't understand the work of Hashem and the work of his deeds. The work of his hands. So the Medrash on this, the Medrash Tehillim on this pasuk says, "Ki lo yavino pelos Hashem." What is pelos Hashem? What are the works of Hashem? They are Chizkiyahu amar elah hatkufas. According to King Chizkiyahu, this refers to human beings not being able to understand the tkufas, the different eras. In other words, you live in a certain time. We don't have hindsight. We have hindsight, but we don't have foresight necessarily. So we can't understand why things are happening at any one point in time. But according to Rabbi Yeshua amar Elu Hahagadas. This is actually Agada. So we don't necessarily understand 100% exactly what's going on with regards to the Agadas, but they are still extremely important. And these are things that we really do need to know. And we see this later on. We see this further on in source three when it comes to Vayikra Rabba, where it goes, so it's quoting Rabbi Nehemiah, and he's talking about all different areas of Torah that we have to learn, that it's incumbent upon every Jew to learn. And if you go to the end, where I bolded it over here, it says, Mitzvah HaMitzvah, Mikra Mishnah Halachas Talmud Tosfos Agadas. So when it comes to learning about the mitzvahs, the Medrash says, don't just learn halacha and say, that's enough, I'm good, I'm done. You have to learn, keep the entire mitzvah, kol ha-mitzvah. And what does kol ha-mitzvah entail? You have to learn the source for the mitzvah, and you have to learn the Medrash and the Agadas as well, because not just learning how to keep the mitzvah, the actual specific parameters, but also the why about it. What's going on behind the scenes? What's the value of this particular mitzvah, this particular halacha over here? And that will help you with regards to keeping your Torah mitzvahs. The same idea over here is written from the Sifri, and the Sifri says, Talmud Lomer ki im shamar tishmor es kol ha-mitzvah zos. If you want to keep all of the mitzvahs, how do you keep all the mitzvahs? Kol ha-mitzvah lomer. You have to learn the entire area of the mitzvah, which includes medrash, halachas, va'agadas. You have to learn the agadas. You have to learn the idea, the philosophy, the outlook, the ethical values behind it, surrounding all of these mitzvahs too. And that is, I guess, the Sifri is also the quote that I gave you at the very top of your source sheet, where it says, Dorshei Rishumos Oimrim, the expounders of metaphor say, you want to know, you want to come to recognize he who said, and then there was a world. In other words, you want to come to recognize who is Hashem. Lomud Hagada, learn Agada, or learn Medrash, Shebetoichach, because through this, Atamakir es HaKadosh Baruch Hu Medavik Bidrachov. That's how you will come to recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his ways, Umedavik Bidrachov, and cling to his path. In other words, according to Chazal, according to the Sifri, according to Vayikra Rabba, according to the Medrash on Tehillim, one of the ways that we can truly appreciate not just Torah but also Kodesh Baruch Hu and come to understand him and come close to him is by learning Medrash, by learning Agadita. So ultimately, Medrash kind of has two main roles over here. Number one, they help us in the fulfillment of Torah mitzvahs because they help us understand the greater picture, the broader picture of what's going on with them. But also you receive this amazing impact once learning Haggadah so that it actually enables you to come to know HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, and to come close to him as well. So there are a number of different categories of Haggadahs. So the main categories really are, there are two main categories really. We can call them number one, revealed, and number two, concealed. So when it comes to the revealed Agadata, so this we're talking about pretty much very explicit statements concerning a Torah idea that come from Chazal. So one of the most famous ones that I've brought you here on the sheet is everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. It seems like a pretty straightforward statement over here. In other words, everything is up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, everything is, you know, Midei Shamayim, except the idea that it comes down to us to actually have Yerushamayim, to have that emunah and to follow whatever it says, whatever HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to do. And even though that is definitely an open statement, that's considered one of the revealed categories of Agadata, nevertheless, even these kind of statements, these explicit statements and phrases from Chazal, even they are not necessarily quite as open or explicit or easy to understand as we would think. Most of the Mishnahs that make up the Tokiyovich faith fall into this kind of category, into this open-ended kind of statement, into these closed-ended statements where you're meant to pretty much, it's giving you a specific idea, giving you a specific outlook for a derech, and they do need to be studied seriously, but they don't necessarily need to be unpacked or unraveled quite as much as other ones. Even though this one in particular is an interesting one, this Hakol B'Dei Shemayim Chutz Mi Yirat Shemayim, because it really refers to this idea of free will, that everything is in the hands of heaven except a person's free will. And if that's the case, then why doesn't Rabbi Chanina say, HaKol B'Dei Shemayim Chutz Mi B'Chinah Choshech? So even that does need a little bit more unpicking or you know, unraveling. But itself is, you know, it seems like a fairly closed statement. There are other examples as well. For example, here I brought it down with regards to the mitzvah of tzitzit. So Tanya Idachur Isamo Zachim is called mitzvah Hashem Shakula mitzvazu can egg a kolam mitzvah kulam. So regarding the mitzvah of tzitzis, the Gemara says that keeping the mitzvah of tzitzis is equal to keeping all of the mitzvahs altogether. And we know that's the case because Rashi says if you take a look at the gematria of the word tzitzis is a tofresh, is 600. And then when you take a look at the five knots and the eight strings, then that equals 613. And that's the clue to indicate that wearing tzitzis is equal to all 613 mitzvahs altogether. But that brings up another question. We know that there's that the reason that the Torah tells us to wear tzitzis is, and that's that last source there, 5C from Bamidbar, that the reason why we wear tzitzis in general is so that we can actually remember to do all the other mitzvahs. So are tzitzis equal all the other mitzvahs, or are they there as a reminder to perform all the other mitzvahs? And if tzitzis are equal all the other mitzvahs, well, what about this idea of Shabbos? Because we know that there's many, many statements throughout Chazal, throughout the Gemara, that talk about the importance of keeping Shabbos. And they say how keeping Shabbos is equal to all the other mitzvahs. So which one? Is it Shabbos or is it keeping tzitzit or is it wearing tzitzit? So even these statements, which seem fairly straightforward, also do need to have more explanation going on there. But that's really the first category of understanding Agada, or the first category of Agada, the revealed statements. The second category of Agadata is a lot more complicated. So this one is this idea of the stories or the mashalim or the encounters, the conversations that take place with different personalities or different famous people or perhaps not so much famous people that are in Tanakh or that are mentioned, that are brought out in the Talmud. And these stories are a lot more mysterious. It describes various events and various episodes in ways that are very unusual and often seem very unrealistic or fantastical or implausible. And those kinds of midrashim leave us very uncertain as to what to make of it. Now, we know that they're important. We know that they're vital to being, you know, a fully functioning Yid and appreciating Torah and Yiddishkeit and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But how are we meant to approach stories and encounters of this particular nature when they just seem way too mysterious to actually possibly be true? So I want to take a story of this nature and use that as a case study to show how Chazal, in their great wisdom, understand Medrash in general and how we are supposed to approach the study of Medrash and of these kinds of Medrash Agada in particular. So this classic, this example, is the story of Oig, Oig Melech HaBashan, and how he met his death. So we're on page, On the second page, with regards to Oig Melech HaBashan, and we see that this comes straight from the book of Bamidbar, Sefer Bamidbar, and we find a few psukim that deal with this encounter of Oig and Bnei Yisrael. This is in the second last year of the desert. They are almost at Eretz Yisrael. Bnei Yisrael are in Bashan. The pasuk goes as follows: Vayifnu vayalu derech Bashan vayetzei Oig melech Bashan likrasam hu v'chol amoi l'melchama edrei. So they turn, the whole Bnei Yisrael, and they go towards Bashan, where Oig, who's the king, comes forward with all of his men and his entire army to wage war with them. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, and Hashem says to Moshe, Al tira oisoi, don't be afraid of him, ki biyadcha nasati oisoi, because into your hand I have delivered him, ve'es kol amoi and his entire nation, ve'es artoi and all his lands, ve'asisa loi ka'asher asisa l'sichoi melech amoidi, and I will do to him exactly, or you shall do to him, sorry, exactly as you did to Sichoin, King of Melech Amori, the king of the Amori, Asher Yoshev B'Cheshvan, who lives in Cheshvan. And Moshe takes heart at this advice, at these words of Hashem. And what happens? Vayaku Oisoi, they struck him, Ve'es Bonov and all his sons, Ve'es Kol Amoi and his entire nation, Ad Bilti Hishir Lo Sorid, until there was not a single survivor, but Yishros Artsoi, and they took possession of his land. These are the three psukim dealing with the death of Oig, or the conquest of Oig by Moshe and Bnei Yisrael. It's interesting, this is one of the rare occasions where, you know, we've seen Moshe Rabbeinu waging war against numerous enemies. This is one of the occasions where we can see, interestingly enough, that Moshe is afraid. He thinks there's a chance that he won't win, that Bnei Yisrael won't be successful over here. We know this because Hashem has to say to him, Al tira oisoi, don't be scared of him. Don't be afraid. It's okay. Just like you defeated all your other enemies, you're going to defeat this one as well. So what is it about Oig that Moshe is scared of? So Rashi on this pasuk of Vayaku oisoi, that they struck him, they slew him, he says, Moshe haragoi, Moshe kills him. Kideisa bibrachos baharoye, as it says in Mishnah Brachos, that starts with haroye, Akav tura bar talasa parse v'chulu, that he pick up a rock that was bar talasa parse, that was measuring 3 parsang, and he threw it at him, etc. So we turn to the Gemara Brachas to find what is the story going on here. And this is a classic example of a Medrash Agada that seems fairly fantastical in nature and very difficult to understand. It's a famous story. It's probably a story you've known. It's a story you've grown up with. It's definitely one of those stories that are found in the Little Midrash says and in the Midrash says, and definitely one of those stories that I always learnt in school growing up, like this is how Oig died. But when you look at it with, I guess, more adult eyes or more questioning eyes, you think to yourself, hang on a second, how could this even happen? There's lots of troubling details going on over here. So what's the story? Eben Shabikesh Oig Melech HaBashan Lizroik Al Yisrael, the stone that Oig wanted to throw on Bnei Yisrael. Gemara Gemurele, the Gemara tells us that he said, Omar Machane Yisrael Kama Habe. How big is the camp of Yisrael? How large is it? Habe Tlatsa Parse. It's 3 parsang long. So I have the whole Gemara there written for you, but I'll pretty much just say how it goes outside, but you're more than welcome to look at it inside. Pretty much the Gemara tells us that he looked around to find a mountain that was as big as Machane Yisrael. For those of you that are wondering how big a parsang is, so I looked it up. A parsa is approximately 8,000 amas. An amma is approximately 48 centimeters. Or 20 inches approximately. So 50 centimeters is approximately 20 inches. So a parsang is about 4 kilometers or 2.5 miles. So that means times that by three, this mountain is approximately 12 by 12 kilometers or 7.5 by 7.5 miles. That's how big the camp of Yisrael was. And that's how big this rock is that Oig tries to find. So he picks it up and he says, I'm going to pick it up. And I'm going to hurl it on top of them, and I'm going to smash the entire camp of Bnei Yisrael, and that's how I'm going to defeat them. Gemara explains that he picks it up, he brings it on his head, lifts it on top of his head. What happens? HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings some kind of insect into this mountain. They start biting away at the insides of this mountain, gnawing away with their teeth. The whole mountain falls down around his neck, trapping his hands next to his neck. And as he goes to try and remove this very awkward, massive necklace, stone necklace that's now trapping his hands next to his face, he can't lift it up with his hands anymore because the whole thing's kind of, you know, been hollowed out by the ants that have been chewing away at it, or termites, however you want to call them, and it's fallen down around him. So he gets his teeth and he, tries to stick his teeth into this mountain. And his teeth grow, and so they extend, they pierce all the way in through one side of the mountain and out through the other. And he's completely stuck. His hands are by his head. His teeth are stuck in the mountain all the way till they're piercing through. It's absolutely impossible for him to be able to break the mountain at all. And as he's trapped there with this rock that's hanging around his neck, then we get to the famous part of the story. Moshe Kamahu, how tall was Moshe? Eser Amos. Moshe was 10 Amos tall. Shakil Nirgabar Eser Amin. He took an axe that was 10 cubits, 10 Amos long. Shavbar Eser Amin. He jumped up 10 Amos. Umachaye Bar Kusalia Vekatalia. And he hit Oig in the ankle and he killed him. 10 plus 10 plus 10. And Oig is dead. There's the famous story. But we have a lot of questions on this story. The first question really is, how big would Oig have to be to carry a mountain that was that size? A mountain that's 7.5 by 7.5 miles, or, what did we say? How many kilometers? I put it over here in the footnotes, about 4 by 4 kilometers. I mean, that's absolutely massive. 12 by 12 kilometers, that's absolutely enormous. How on earth is there a person that is possibly big enough to pick up a mountain that big, that massive, to be able to squash the entire of Machane Yisrael? And we have a bigger question when we think, you could think, okay, maybe it's possible that there were giants that were that large. But when you look in Torah, Torah itself actually gives us a bit of an indication as to how large Oig was. So in Sefer Devarim, it says, Kirak Oig Melech HaBashan Nishar Miyeser Harafoyim, Kinei Arsoi Eres Barzel. He had, Oig was one of the only ones left from the Rafoyim. He had a massive bed, Halohi Barabbas Bnei Amon, which is now in Amon. Tesha Amos Arka, it was 9 Amos long. Ba'arba amos rachba and 4 amos wide, ba'amos ish, according to the standard measure of an amma. And we know whenever it says something in Torah, that's 100% as it is. Whatever it says in Torah, whatever descriptions, however things are described, that 100% is how it happened. So according to here, Oig Melech HaBashan, if his bed is 9 amos, you would assume that he's about 9 amos long. And the reason, the Torah is like describing how massive this bed of iron is to show how enormous Oig was. 9 amos is absolutely massive size for a human being. A human being is approximately 4.5 to 5 amos high. That's the average size of a human being. So for a man to come along that's 9 amos long, I mean, that's just huge. Yes, 100%, that's a giant. We know actually From other places, we see how big other kinds of giants were. For example, when it talks about Goliath, the Medrash describes him as half a giant. So he was larger than an average person, but he was smaller than a full-fledged giant because he wasn't a pure-blood giant. He had mixed blood there. He had one parent was a human, one parent had the giant gene, and Goliath himself was 7.5 amas high, or 7.5 amas tall. So even, you know, and that was considered massive and enormous. So Oig Melech HaBashan, 9 amas tall, there's no way someone 9 amas tall can pick up a rock that is that massive. There is absolutely no way that's going to happen. So how could it possibly be that Oig Melech HaBashan could lift up a mountain of this size? Also, if we said that Moshe, if he had to be this big in order to be able to pick up a mountain of that size, then 30 amas up from the ground, would have represented just a minuscule fraction of his height. There's no way that Moshe being 10 amos and the axe being 10 amos and him jumping up 10 amos, there's no way that would have even reached his ankle. That probably still would have been somewhere around the soles of his feet. The second big question that we have is, if the ants are truly gnawing away and eating into the mountain, then it's not going to fall around his head. It's just going to crumble around everywhere. It's not going to become that perfect necklace. The third question we have is, if Hashem doesn't want Oig to hurt the Yidden in the first place, and that Bnei Yisrael are going to be, they're going to be victorious anyway, so then why doesn't he just make Oig unable to uproot the mountain in the first place? I can see that comment, that question over here. What about Rashi's comment that says that the Amos were actually Oig-sized Amos? Whenever it comes to a description that's actually directly in the Tanakh, that's written in Torah Shavuot Sav, and then you have different kinds of descriptions that are mentioned in Torah Shavuot Peh, you have to rely on the Torah Shavuot Sav. That comes first. And Torah Shavuot Peh is there to give you added information, but we're going to actually, I'll explain that later on when we come to what's the point of the size of the Amos in the first place? What does it actually mean over here? Do we take it literally or not? The fourth question that we actually have is, so with all of his size, with all of his strength, if he was actually so enormous, then how on earth was Oig able to be killed just from being struck in the ankle? Like, who cares? That would have been, it would have hurt him a bit, but would it actually have killed him? So how are we meant to approach stories of this type? And what are we meant to learn from stories of this type? So in his commentary to the Mishnah Sanhedrin, Perek Yud, Rambam actually identifies three different groups or three different approaches to this type of medrash that are adopted by three different groups of Yidden. So the first group would be the literal believers. The second group would be the literal disbelievers. And the third group would just be the believers. So let's try and define what these groups are. The first group, literal believers. This is a group that believes that whatever Chazal say, 100% is true, exactly as they said it. They draw nothing out of the Agadata except for what they read or what they hear at face value. And the Rambam has a lot of time for this group, like he sympathizes with this group, and he says that their approach is very simplistic, but it's based on a reverence and an acknowledgement of the greatness of Chazal. Like, if Chazal said that these things happened, then this is literally what happened, and that's that. Unfortunately, as the Rambam then goes on to explain, the outcome actually becomes the opposite. Like, they're doing it to revere and to honor Chazal, but what's really happening is that they're kind of making Chazal, the Divrei Chazal, into a little bit of a joke, a little bit of a mockery, because they've completely missed the point of the Agadata, of what this story is meant to be trying to tell them, and of the deeper meaning that's kind of hidden within these stories. And this, in the end, doesn't bring any honor to the Torah or to Chazal at all. But the Rambam has time for them because he says they're coming from a good place. The second group are the group of literal disbelievers. So this second group also understands that all the Agadas and all the Mishnah and all the Midrashim that Chazal say, yes, also take them literally. But unlike the first group, they're not willing to understand it like that. And they say, yeah, whatever Chazal said, they believe, but it's rubbish, clearly. So they actually end up ridiculing Chazal for engaging in such, you know, crazy stories and outlandish ideas. And the Rambam actually speaks quite harshly about them because he says they're deliberately distorting and misunderstanding the words of the sages in order to ridicule them, in order to bring shame to the Torah. The third group, that's the group that Rambam says that this is the correct approach to understanding Medrash Haggadah. And this group understands that there are many Haggadahs that are meant to be taken as a moshel, as an allegory, or that contain important Torah messages or concepts, but they're not necessarily to be taken literally at face value, as in this 100% happened the way it says. And that notion of using a moshel or a story to convey an idea, this isn't new. It's not something that, you know, the Torah Baal Peh made up, Chas v'Shalom. The wisest of all men, Shlomo HaMelech, right? He used this idea. He composed an entire sefer in Tanakh that's made up of entirely Mesholim. It's the book of Mishle, right? It's the whole book of Proverbs, of allegories, etc. And Chazal pretty much are essentially carrying on with this tradition. The hard thing for us to understand, really, is, well, how are we supposed to understand what is what? You know, when we come across a particular medrash, how are we supposed to know which ones to understand or to take literally and which ones are there to be understood really as a moshel? So the Rambam, he comes up with something, he comes along and says something very interesting. He actually says that he also in the commentary to Mishnah Sanhedrin, he says that he's planning on writing an entire section, an entire igeres, a letter, that discusses which Haggadahs he feels should be taken literally and which ones are to be understood more as a moshel. But this work was never written. Or perhaps he wrote it and either it was hidden or we have yet to come across it. So it's an interesting one. Rambam himself felt that there was definitely value in, you know, kind of separating or putting into categories or categorizing all the different kinds of midrashim that are out there in order to so that we should know 100%. Yes, this happened exactly as is, and this is pretty much more as a moshel, but we don't have this list. He either never wrote it or he wrote it and we don't have it. Either way, we do have many other amazing parshadim and great people in our past who were able to, who do explain all of the midrashim that you come across in Tanakh, in the Talmud, in the Gemara, in Torah Baal Peh, and who are able to give us indications or kind of guide us in the correct approach to how to understand them. The Rashba is a big one, the Maharsha, the Ben Yehoyada, all of these kind of of these parshanim, or I should say maybe just anyone that pretty much is explains in Yaakov, these are the kinds of individuals that do help us to take a look at the more difficult to understand stories of Midrashim that are out there and show us what we're supposed to learn from these stories. With regards to this particular story of the episode of Oig in the mountain, we're going to use the Rashba and see how he explains that the Gemara is using this as a moshel. So first of all, the mountain that he holds over his head. Mountains very often are used as in throughout actually Tanakh for our ovis. Our ovis are referred to as mountains every so often in different places. You've got one over here where in Tanakh where it says Shamatamodos Chushal Avram Avinu, or in Sefer Yeshayahu where it says Shumayalayvot Vetzedekun Vakshe Hashem Habitu El Tzuru Chutzavtem, look to the rock, look to the mountains from which you came from. And there are a number of other places throughout Tanakh where our ovis are actually referred to as mountains. And according to the Medrash over here, this particular idea, the mountain that he's holding over the heads, exactly, the mountain that he's holding over the head of Bnei Yisrael, this is the mountain, this is the schus ovis that Oig himself actually has. This is the merit of him helping one of our ovis, Avram Avinu. What did he do to help Avram? He's the one that goes and tells Avram that his nephew Lot has been captured by the four kings, and Lot goes to go and help them. Okay, to go and rescue his nephew Lot. That is why Moshe Rabbeinu is scared. he knows that Oig has this amazing schus. He has helped Avraham Avinu. And he understands that this perhaps is the reason why Oig is still alive, still is existing all the way up until this point in time. Many, many hundreds of years has passed. We know Oig is the one that was saved in, you know, Noah by the Teva. And he managed to outlive Avram, and he managed to outlive Yitzchak and Yaakov and the Shvatim, and now he's here with Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe is petrified. He's thinking to himself, maybe the reason why Oig lived that long is because of this chus, because of the fact that he saved Lot, that he helped Avram Avinu. And Oig himself understands that he has lived for this long in the merit of helping the others. So he picks up this mountain because he's kind of threatening Bnei Israel. He's like, all these other enemies, all these other nations that have tried to get rid of you and have tried to conquer you, you've managed to defeat them all because you have the schus of us on your side. But guess what? I have the schus of us on my side too. I helped one of your ancestors. And he lifts up that mountain. He lifts up that schus, that threat that he has, and he brings them on top of Bnei Israel. This is the kind of power that he's willing, that he's waiting to hurl at Bnei Israel. So what are the ants eating into the mountain then? This refers to the ants, and the ants eating into the mountain refer to Bnei Yisrael. So Sefer Yishayahu again, you've got the pasuk over here, Al tiri toilas Yaakov, fear not, O worm of Yaakov, Masei Yisrael, the men of Yisrael, etc., etc. We are called, we are referred to in a number of different places. The Medrash describes over here why Lama Nimshalo Yisrael the Toilas, why Bnei Yisrael compared to a worm or compared to an insect. Loimar Lacha, to tell us, Ma Toilas Hazoi Eina Maka Es Harozim Ela Befiha, just like worms or insects, they have no power really. They're these defenseless tiny little things, but they are able to chop down great trees, great Harozim. How? Through their mouths, Ela Befiha. And in that way, they're able to weaken and to hit even that which is very strong. So too we, defenseless, the smallest amongst the nations. But where is our power? Also, the fear, Ella Tefillah. We have our power through our mouths, through Tefillah. The ants eating to the mountain refers to the prayers of Bnei Yisrael, which can neutralize any threat, even the biggest one. Bnei Yisrael are compared to these ants, to these insects, because although we are physically very unimposing most of the time, and because we are the smallest amongst all the nations, we have proven time and time again that we are able to completely neutralize a much stronger threat using the power of our mouths, Tefillah. And it's interesting that it says like many, many ants or many, many insects came to devour this mountain because we know how effective the tefillah of one person can be. The kavachover, it's nowhere near as effective as when all of Bnei Yisrael are kind of focused and working together and praying together for a particular idea. Now, at this point, Oi begins to see, okay, maybe this is it for me. Maybe at this point I'm not going to be successful. And he wants to put this mountain down. It starts crumbling around him. But effectively, he gets trapped. The mountain hangs around his neck. And not only that, but when he tries to get rid of it and he kind of bites it with his teeth, with his shinayim, his teeth start growing into it. And it completely prevents him from being unable to do so, from being able to, you know, rip that rock off his head. Always we know that the teeth of a wicked person, that represents their primal urge, their desire. That represents their wickedness, right? What's the Rasha? What do we say with the Rasha at Pesach? Hakeh Shinov, get rid of their teeth, get rid of the wickedness, and then the Rasha will be okay. Then the Rasha will be all right. The teeth of an anti-Semite, or the teeth of a Rasha, that represents their actual rishus, their actual hatred, their evil. And although Oig realizes on an intellectual level that if he continues going on and persists in this battle to try and attack the Yidden, he's going to lose, his base desire and his innate hatred to inflict damage on Bnei Yisrael, it completely prevents him from being able to back down. And it's not the last, and it's certainly not the first time in history that one of our enemies had had his absolute hatred of us completely outweigh any sense of self-preservation always the hatred of the non-Jews, of our enemies. That's kind of what's let us out or moved us completely or completely destroyed themselves. I guess a classic example of this would be the idea, World War II. We know that when it comes to Hitler, he was, did everything in his power. It was his hatred that, led him to, make a Holocaust, etc. But at a certain point in World War II, when the tide was turning and it was clear that Germany was losing and Hitler was pretty much, that's it, nothing's going to happen. And this is when he's already, invading Russia and Russia conquered him. What ends up happening is that all his generals, they pretty much convince him that we need to take all of these trains, as many as we can, and send them to and send them to Russia, send them to the front that we're fighting over there, because the soldiers need more soldiers, we need more weapons, we need more food, we need more ammunition, etc., etc. And he overrides all of the generals' advice and he diverts all of those trains, sending them to Hungary to pick up as many last remaining Jews as he possibly can to send them to the gas chambers. It was his incredible hatred, his incredible sinner, that caused his own downfall in the end. And we see these examples time and time again, that the hatred that they have towards us, that has completely outweighed their own sense of self-preservation or really where they should be going. And it's truly, like Rashi says, sinah mishuteres es hashura, that hatred completely diverts the right path and completely, mishuteres, completely, twists the right way that a person's supposed to go. At this point in time, Moshe Rabbeinu enters the picture. What does he do? He is 10. He jumps up 10, he has an axe that's 10. The number 10 always represents shlemos, represents perfection. Doesn't mean to say that Moshe necessarily is 10 amos tall. It can't be, because he's not a giant, he is a man. And Oyv himself, according to the pshat, is only 9 amos. But what does it mean then? Moshe is 10. It reflects his perfection as a person, as a leader, as an Eved Hashem. The axe that he's wielding, that represents Bnei Yisrael, also at this point in time, 10. They're about to enter Eretz Yisrael. They're at the peak of who they are as a nation. Jumping up 10, representing the jumping up, taking all of the merits and all of the zchuyos that are of the Ovis and every and all our great ancestors from the past, etc., that the Jewish people have enjoyed. And all of these merits, all of these chosim combined, that helps Moshe to deliver the fatal blow to Oyd's ankle. Why dafka an ankle? Because that is the one area that Oyd actually has a chos. He used his feet, he used his ankles to run to tell Avram about the war in stone. And of course, Moshe Rabbeinu completely vanquishes Oyd and the threat is neutralized. So yeah, it's a story that seems to be talking about mountains and ants and rocks and teeth. But in reality, this story is discussing, or this medrash over here is discussing, really fundamental ideas. What kind of ideas? Zchus Ovis, the merit that our Ovis have, and the merits that we have thanks to our Ovis. The idea also that Rishoyim are rewarded for their mitzvahs, for their good deeds in this world, in order that HaKadosh Baruch Hu shouldn't have to reward them in the world to come. That's one of those questions that kids ask the whole time, why do good things happen to bad people, and vice versa. This is one of the ways that the Medrash is addressing that particular idea. Of course, the very, very important concept in Yiddishkeit of the power of prayer, and not just the power of personal tefillah, but the power of tefillah in a group, in a nation. And then, of course, the very nature of anti-Semitism itself. Why are we hated? Why is it so irrational? Why does it keep coming up again and again and again? These are the kinds of ideas that Chazal, in their wisdom, are bringing up here. It seems in a story, in something simple, it's something like easy, something we hear and read about as kids. but these are concepts that are so deep and so incredibly nuanced and important to Yiddish faith, and they're all here wrapped up in a story that seems, you know, a good story kind of for kids. So if that's the case, your story that, you know, it's a nice story, but it's really discussing, you know, fundamental and really foundational ideas in Yiddish faith, well, why don't Chazal just say these amazingly important ideas in Yiddishkeit outright? What's the point of wrapping them up in stories, in Midrashim like this? So one of the more direct agadic statements that actually does require a lot of thought and a lot of, delving into is actually the specific way in which the statement's phrased. So the Mishnah in Kirti Avos, another famous Mishnah, it says about the words of Chazal, V'chol divrehem kegachalei esh. All of their words are like coals of fire. So the Ramchal from Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, so he points out that the Midrash doesn't say that all their words are like fire. It says all their words are like coals of fire, gachalei esh. So the point behind this metaphor is that at first glance, a piece of coal may not look like it's containing fire. Can look like it's just an ordinary grey piece of rock. But in order to extract the fire from this coal, a person needs to really work with it. A person needs to stoke it and to fan it or to hit it. And only then will the fire be revealed, will the fire come out. And that's the same way that we're supposed to understand the words of Chazal, that some of these statements, some of these stories, they may seem straightforward, but when a person ponders them and explores them and discovers them, then the fire begins to emerge. Then the fire begins to come out. So why do they use these kinds of mishalim in general? You know, that we have to actually unravel them and understand exactly what's going on behind them in order to actually fathom their message or come to some kind of an understanding. What is Chazal? What was the point of all of this? So the Rambam says that the ideas that are contained within agadas of this nature, the more mysterious nature, very deep, very esoteric, and therefore, there was a real concern that they could possibly be misunderstood by people who maybe are not developed enough, either intellectually developed enough, or maybe they've never had the chance to really learn properly enough in order to fully grasp their meaning. So therefore, in order to protect these concepts from falling into unqualified hands, for want of a better word, then the Chachamim concealed them in Mishalim, in allegories, or in Midrashim, like the one we just learned. So that encountering the agata, that in itself is kind of like a selection process. Presumably, this is what Chazal were deciding, according to the Rambam, someone who is capable of unraveling this deep inner meaning of the agata, they would be the ones that would then be able to handle the idea that's contained within it correctly and use it in the right manner. But if a person just comes across this Maamar Chazal, this story, this Medrash, this Agadata, and is completely incapable of fathoming the, you know, the deeper meaning, that in itself is a sign that actually the idea contained within it maybe is beyond him, and it's good that he just heard a nice story, pretty much. And in Moran Avuchim, the Rambam pretty much says the same thing. He talks about how there's different levels of the neshama. At the end of this whole discussion, this whole talk, where he talks about the different levels of the neshama, he pretty much concludes by saying that the reason why Chachamim spoke in riddles and in mashalim and in agadata, in allegory, is due to the depth of the wisdom being contained within these ideas in ways that are perhaps beyond the capacity of most people to properly comprehend. And that's why they concealed it, to hide it. So is it possible that someone might pick it up but not fully consciously, 100%? And what if you maybe are not at that level that you cannot fully understand things on their own? Well, thankfully, we have a lot of version, we have a lot of, you know, commentaries all the way up until today that help us to delve deeply into that. So that it actually does reveal it for us and breaks it apart, like the Rashba did over here, where he takes step by step, he explains what are the teeth and what is the mountain and what is the rock, etc., so that we can understand and we can appreciate this, the incredible beauty and the messages that are contained within the Medrash, even if perhaps we can't do it ourselves. Pretty much, we have to assume, or we can pretty much understand that there's the Rabbonim Chazal considered the danger of these concepts falling into the wrong hands to be significantly worse than that of the Our Goddess themselves being completely misunderstood by people. That's why they were so happy and willing to have these ideas down there, but to have them kind of enclosed in a story form. And if you're willing to take the time and the effort into researching these stories and into reading what Chazal have to say about and what Al-Mufarshim have to say about all of these stories, oh, then you're the one that's correct, that's able to properly learn and understand and have access to the incredible messages that are contained within it. And if the ideas contained within the Our Goddess are reserved for those that are able to unravel them, then, you know, perhaps for us nowadays, that's why we have so many more Mufarshim, so many more works that are there working on, that are there kind of pretty much putting point by point down there for us that we can understand it. We can understand and know all of these amazing secrets and messages that the Chazal wanted. There's one more interesting point, and that is that one of the significant aspects of a moshel is that these are that sometimes we know that we know that Yiddishkeit is like meant to be a religion that's a beautiful synthesis between the heart and the mind. So we have a lot of intellect going on over there, but we also have to have a lot of feeling towards what we are doing as well. So the graphic picture that is formed by a moshel, by a story, that speaks to the heart directly. Right? You can talk at length, you can, you know, give so many sources about the importance of and the power of tefillah, but there's an emotional message that really will only be conveyed by portraying the Bnei Yisrael davening as tiny ants eating away at a massive mountain. And you can tell, you can explain to students that, you know, anti-Semitism is irrational in nature, that we cannot understand it. But the picture of Oig trying as hard as he can, even when he knows that he's going to lose, and his teeth growing out of a mountain, rendering him physically incapable of putting that mountain down, that's what really brings, you know, it's literally a rock around his neck. It's strangling him. That kind of brings this message home to the heart. So we find this beautiful irony, also explained by Rabbi Bernstein, within Our Goddess that use Mishalim of this nature. He says that an Agarata really has two parts. They have the outside, the moshel, the story, and then they have the inside, the nimshel, or the concept. It's the outside of the Agada, the story, the moshel, that will most often reach the inside of the person, his heart. That'll give him that emotional connection, that feeling, that inspiration. But it's the inside of the Agada, the really important concepts that Chazal are trying to convey to us, like the nature of anti-Semitism, the power of tefillah, etc., that is going to be processed by the outside of the person, the intellectual faculties going on over here. And the goal of Agadata, which is to help us become close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, know Hashem, know ourselves, know Torah, etc., that's not realized until the entire person is reached, both the inside and the outside, so that we can be enlightened and inspired, really, to become better Yidden, closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that, I hope, in that way, I hope I managed to explain somewhat, according to the Rambam, what is the point of Midrash Haggadah, how to approach it. Yes, I agree, it would have been a lot easier if we would have just had that list from the Rambam, every Midrash to be understood literally and every Midrash not. But thankfully, we live today where we have so many resources out there at our fingertips. And if we don't understand Lashon HaKodesh necessarily, then so much is translated into English nowadays where people are going and explaining where our amazing, you know, Mufarshim, our amazing Chazal have explained for us step by step, every step of the way, these incredible Midrash HaKodesh for us, that we can truly appreciate them, not just for the great stories that they are, but also from what really exists. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good joke over there. Yes, if Oig was alive from the times of Avraham Avinu, definitely he was a little long in the tooth. Good one. I'm going to use that. Thank you. Okay. That's it, Devorah.
Thank you so much. You can open the floor if anyone has any questions. We have a few minutes, you know, left to our allotted spot.
Okay.
Wonderful, as I remember.
Okay.
And yeah, we appreciate you giving your time and sharing your insight all the way from Australia.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Good to be here. That last question at the end, the mountain falling as a necklace, that's just that idea of a burden around his neck that he actually physically can't lift off at all. And Oig's teeth symbolise the rishus, or the hatred of a Russia, or the nature of anti-Semitism in general, where it's something that's completely irrational, that even when it doesn't make sense at all, they'll still continue in a certain way. A lot more explained. The Rebbe explains a lot about that with regards to getting rid of Amalek and why it's so important to do so. If Rashi's pshat, where does his comment come in about Oig-sized Amos? I'm not sure exactly. It's a good one. I'll have to look back at that again. Thank you. Thank you for that question.
Can I ask a question?
I can try and answer it, sure.
So when and how do we make this switch when we're teaching children to go from, you know, the stories that sound so exciting to get into the deeper meaning?
So I guess there's, it's a good question. I've had it myself, because I know that myself as a kid, you know, you love these midrashim. That's what makes things so interesting and exciting and juicy. So I would say definitely to kids, keep teaching them. Why not? But when they start getting older and having questions on these midrashim, like how on earth could it be possible that X, Y, and Z, okay, that's the time to now start exploring these midrash and opening them up perhaps to the concepts or the ideas or the way that the midrash is supposed to be taught or supposed to be understood. I find that starts happening in high school. I'm teaching high school now, and these are the kinds of questions I get very often. And it helps a lot when you have a Maharsha or a Ben Yahyada that can explain them for you. So you just, you know, open it up and say, here it is. This is what you're supposed to know. This is the message that's contained within this particular story.